Welcome back to the program. Before it was hip, popular, or trendy, our guest this morning, David Masumoto, was writing about food, connecting the origins of food to the work of farming, to the connection between families and the land that sustains them. He is a third-generation farmer. He grows certified organic peaches, nectarines, and grapes with his family on their 80-acre California farm. He's the author of the award-winning Epitaph for a Peach. It is my pleasure to have David Masumoto back to talk about his new book, Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Great to have you here. Are you finding that more and more young people today are attracted to farming, understand what it really can contribute to the world?
That's one of the wonderful new pleasures I have, is to see this new energy that's coming from a younger generation. I know when I was went to college some couple decades ago, you actually whispered that you were from a farm because you were, you know, it wasn't something that was very popular, and most of the youth at that point were leaving the land. But now I think people think farming is cool. Makes me wish I was very young again. But it's also a pleasure to see and witness that, because now we see a little continuity in farms, because you can see another generation wanting to farm, wanting to work the earth, and wanting to grow the foods we eat.
What do you think has changed? Why do you think farming has become cool again?
I think two things. One, this generation grew up learning about the environment and taking environmental classes and curriculum in school. It was unheard of when I was young to actually learn about the environment and think of it in a different way. This generation grew up with it, and it was part of their education. It was part of how they saw the world. So I think that changed a lot of things. The other thing is, I think food and farming are now merged together. It wasn't something that was separate, as if food magically appeared at the grocery store. When you have a connection like that, people then start developing a type of relationship with their food. And in this sense, I think a new generation is developing a relationship with the land, relationship with how food is grown, and of course that leads to a relationship with farmers.
Are you finding that this is something that is happening across the country in urban and suburban areas alike, or is this a phenomenon that's more limited to places like California, where we are?
I think it begins often in areas that have a large urban population. It maybe has to do with, because I think a lot of this younger generation, they're coming from non-farm backgrounds, which is fairly new in the phenomena of farms. So I think it begins with these urban centers that I think have this critical mass. Maybe there's much more conversation and dialogue in terms of reframing our food systems, and there's this interest about agriculture, which helps these young apprentices, if you want to call them that, to have a connection with the land. I think in more rural areas, farming is still seen as this very separate culture, often a culture that isn't exactly attractive. Even in the valley, our farm is near Fresno, California. You know, farming sometimes is made light of, let me put it that way, in that sense. But it's in the urban areas, I think there is this affinity that people are having with their food and, of course, then with farmers.
What are young people finding, what are you seeing today with respect to the economics of farming? How much easier or more difficult is it for young people that, as you say, do not come from farm families necessarily, to get in the business, to have a piece of the action?
This may sound odd, but in a wonderful way, I think they're very naive and innocent, which is exactly what you may have to go into farming these days. And let me explain that. When I say naive, I think they're going in because they have a passion to do the work that they want to do. They have this calling to want to work with the land, to grow things. They may be naive in the sense that they're not quite realizing the amount of hard work that's required and the lack of income that's going to come from it. However, it's that kind of passion, I think, that will drive them to sustain themselves and understand that maybe farming is more like being an artist as opposed to a business person, so that you're not in that profession in order to make lots of money. You're not going to go into agriculture because you have a business plan of your life. I think that is going to be their strength. Because of that, they start learning how to farm in a very innocent way, quickly start learning, oh, there's these economic realities, and then start applying new models of how you survive and how you sustain yourself in agriculture. Because in many ways, the existing model of a farm, such as you buy land, you start growing a conventional crop, you sell it at a wholesale level, wave goodbye, and hope people give you a little money for it, that model isn't always working smoothly, as we've witnessed in terms of a lot of the demise of a lot of family farms.
Mm-hmm. And is technology playing a part in any of this, either positively or negatively?
Oh, I think technology is playing a great role, mostly for the good, I have to say. I'm not a thrill when people get mad at me because they can't get a hold of me on my cell phone while I'm on my tractor, and I have to tell them, when you're on an old diesel tractor, you're not going to be able to hear it ring, and vibration doesn't work on it. So, but in the other sense, I think that role of technology is helping to bridge that schism between urban and rural. So, for example, the younger generation, very tuned in to use of the internet, use of the web, use of understanding these technological aspects to get information, to help market and sell and promote their crops, to help connect with a different audience that is also wired, that's also connected. And I see that as a great asset. It's just like on our farm, we decided to revamp our web page, because we had this old clunky web page that I thought was fine, but my 23-year-old daughter said, no, we need to re-examine it. So we re-examined it, and she suggested that we reframe the web page so that it just doesn't tell a little bit about our farm. It actually says, let's divide our farm into different aspects. So on it, we have a section called the family farm that talks about our life, our farm. Another section that talks about the literary farm, which is about my writing and the role of my writing on it. And another part that talks about the public farm, and that has the public aspects that we do on the land. And in that sense, she helped reframe our farm for the public, and it actually makes a lot of sense. And I think that's where the younger generation actually comes with new tools that when I went back to the farm, I didn't have.
Just as your daughter has moved you into a newer technological age with respect to this, talk a little bit about the way it's changed from your father passing the farm on to you.
There's this wonderful, you might call it paradox, of the old and new working side by side. For example, on our organic farm, one of the quests that will always challenge us has to do with how do you take care of weeds. The old school was you just simply got a shovel and you went out in the fields and you took care of them. That hasn't changed. However, there are some other newer tools that we use in a complex issue, and I'll try to answer it as simply as possible, has to do with pest control. And we now use what they call pheromone strips. And pheromones are the scent of female moths. And in a nutshell, we trick male moths in the field by flooding it with this fake female scent of a female moth, so we don't have any mating that occurs. And that was developed in this highly sophisticated process of hanging these little plastic strips that emit the scent of a female moth for 3 months. It's very technical, very scientific. I thank the PhD student who made this their dissertation project someplace. And it's very sophisticated, and it works wonderful. And that, I think, is an example of that juxtaposition of the old and new working side by side in this newer farming world that we live in.
One of the things that is happening, and this relates to your relationship with your father and your daughter's decision, as you write about, to come back to the farm, is that the farm once again is becoming a family farm rather than family selling out to large agriculture, that because kids are coming back, it's changing the dynamic of a lot of these farms.
One of the themes that I developed in writing Wisdom of the Last Farmer was to examine this legacy of generations. And the book begins with my father's stroke and this sudden realization of mortality and this sense of, well, what happens when one generation has a stroke and relationships change? My dad survived that stroke, but I realized what I had to do was, in order for him to recover, I had to teach him the farm. So there is this changing role in that I was no longer the student, I had to become the teacher. Part of that has been lost as generations left the land and farms were not continuing. This idea of legacy as being something alive as opposed to something more like a memorial. So it's not nostalgia anymore. It's something that's happening. So on our farm, we had to grapple and with these changes and what does it mean in terms of another generation taking over, side by side with the theme of the old theory of farming, hard work, hard physical work, which I don't think will ever change, nor do I want it to change. Because when you take away certain traditions, we'll call it that, such as the hard physical work, and replace it with capital, a more industrialized model, you lose that family element of a family farm. You lose that personal connection. That personal connection becomes part of that legacy that's passed down from generation to generation. So as I worked with my dad, as I described in Wisdom of the Last Farmer, and begin to redefine what it means to be the last farmer. So suddenly my dad wasn't going to be the last farmer. For a while I thought I was, because I was taking over the land, and I wasn't sure what my children would do. My wonderful daughter, Nikiko, and my son have talked about, and my daughter has committed to coming back to the farm. Suddenly that changes definitions, because you have continuity. You have a sense of that legacy meaning something else, being not only passed down but redefined by another generation. That, I think, adds this wonderful new life to the farm, something that's essential, I think, to family farms.
As these family farms get passed on now, as this legacy continues, as you talk about, how do these family farms exist side by side competitively with big agribusiness today?
One of the wonderful things that has evolved in the last 10 to 20 years is a parallel economy, if you want to call it that. And I'm certainly not an economist, so I'm not sure exactly what the correct term is, but it's what I see. And, for example, you can see it very simply in the rise and expansion of farmers markets. 20 years ago, there were a few farmers markets. Very few. Now there are hundreds. And even in these smaller towns and suburb areas, there are these new farmers markets growing. Farmers markets, for the most part, are being supplied by small family farms who often live in a local area. This is a new kind of economic dimension of farming. And I see that as being something that for once supports the small operation and rewards us for being local, rewards us for being small and very mobile with our crops. It also has, the marketplace has shifted. When organics became certified, established, defined, and the marketplace started shifting it, initially, many small farms were those organic farms. The landscape has changed now. However, a lot of organic produce is still grown by small operations. A lot is not, too. The definitions have to have, the expansion of corporate farming into organics has taken place. However, such as our small operation, we, you know, still have many organic markets, and it allows the consumer in many ways to find out more about the story about their food. In this case, and in our case, it's not only how we grow it organically, certified organic, following certain regulations, but also ask that next question. I don't want to know just how it's grown. I want to know who grows it. When people ask that second and third question, that's where I think you get to that level of authenticity. And once they find out who they grow it, they can start identifying a family operation that's involved with the produce that they eat. So the marketplace has begun to shift in that to help support small family operations. And also, maybe there's a realization that you could have both. It's not either your corporate or all these small farms, because the critique of small operations has always been on the industrial side, well, you can't grow enough food to feed the nation. You can't grow enough to, and that's going to be affordable. And my answer to that is, well, why can't we both exist? We'll have corporate farms to feed the nation with fairly cheap, inexpensive food, and at the same time allow us small operations to coexist, grow something that's very different, provide an alternative for the food system, and also make changes that I think will, no, I don't think, I know will help affect and be a more positive influence on larger corporate farming.
Has organics been a driving force in these changes that we're talking about? Is it organic? Is it the idea of grown locally, of knowing, as you say, who grows the food? What's been the driving force in terms of this change, do you think?
I like to think of it more as a cultural shift. It's just like if you look at the 60s, there wasn't one thing that started changing our society. It was many things happening simultaneously, and I think that's healthy, that it's not just having a federal regulation of defining what is organic. It's not just the new movement to buy local. It's not just the drive to understand who grows your food. It's all of them working simultaneously, because we're talking about not a little marketing paradigm shift. We're talking about a large cultural change. And cultural changes don't occur just in one segment of the population. They occur all across it. And that's how I see it. Because when you develop a new cultural frame of defining your food, you start making lifestyle changes. And that's what I've witnessed that has occurred over the last 20 years. People in our world has started shifting. The earth has moved. And I love that idea, because it also, and I'm not an anthropologist. I'm actually probably a little of all these things put together, but I'm not an anthropologist. However, as I see it, it's as if we're developing this new, the culture is developing, and that's healthy, because a stagnant culture is one that dies.
Is this something that you see as a fad, or something that is sustainable over a long period of time?
Oh, I think it's very sustainable. It's going to go through definitions, and it's just like watching us on the farm and watching neighbors evolve and grow. We all make mistakes. Some make mistakes, and unfortunately can't farm because they've made some very bad mistakes. But that's all part of this cultural shift, where those that survive are those that the ones that figure out how to make a go of it. And that's where I see in many of these young farmers, they're driven by this passion. So they're going to, and that's the key to success. It's not a business plan. It's not having enough capital. It's not having certain marketing strategies. It's having this passion. And with that is this will to find a way. In Wisdom of the Last Farmer, there's a chapter that I talk about welding. And after my father had his stroke, he could no longer weld, and I realized our relationship had changed. I grew up in this wonderful relationship with my father. I broke things, and he fixed them. But after his stroke, I realized I had to start learning how to fix things. I had to learn how to react, how to respond when things break. I think when you look at farming, small-scale farming, and how they're going to survive, how they're going to sustain. Those successful operations have learned how to fix things. They expect things to break, and they have learned how to respond to that. And that is the key. It's not rocket science when you look at business practices. It's not rocket science when you look at cultural shifts. Things that change in our world and evolve, people, groups find a way. And I believe in that, and that may sound very naive, but I do really believe that good people find a way.
How should we be dealing with this, do you think, in terms of education in this country with respect to young people and greater education about some of these issues that we've been talking about?
I think one thing, when we look at education, we often, I think, narrowly define it that it has to occur in a classroom. My wife's involved in education, and I see that, talk about a cultural shift that's occurring in education. That's occurring now with No Child Left Behind and testing and things of that sort. Is that the place, the only place, the absolute answer? No. That's where some education does occur. But I believe in the power of informal education, the education that occurs, you know, at a family table. For example, one of the interesting results of the current terrible economic recession that we're in, people are cooking more at home. They can't afford to go out. They're reviving that sense of having the family dinner. Talk about a place where education occurs. It's in that arena. And that's where I see education occurring, and it's often not just with a young generation. It's across the spectrum. So it's an older generation re-educating themselves, and in many ways in a delightful way, because they're beginning to remember what memory do they have of good food, and understanding the value of that memory. In other words, they might be willing to support a smaller farmer whose price of peaches, for example, may be slightly higher than something that's on sale at a big grocery store, and realizing, you know, value isn't always equated just to economic value. I have this great memory of great food. I want to re-experience that. I will be willing to support a smaller operation and have that experience of a great memory again, and pass that memory down to one generation and another generation, so that education can occur in that informal way. And I think that's how a lot of learning is going to occur. It's a pleasure to meet people who are starting to cook again. I get excited about that because, for example, a lot of our peaches that are presently grown are designed to be eaten fresh. And literally designed, because it was through hibernation and everything, that they said, we're going to grow a peach that, you know, has a longer shelf life and will be delightful eaten when you eat it fresh. A lot of our heirloom peaches that we grow on our farm, we've gone back to those peaches that cook well. So this new change and shift in people wanting to cook at home, in many cases they're having to cook at home because of the economic recession, our fruit fit in that because a lot of these older varieties were designed to cook with. And I think that's just a delight because it's another way people could experience flavor, food, and have a different relationship with it.
Talk about the importance of food writing. Certainly your writing, people like Michael Pollan and Barbara Kingsolver. Talk about how influential that's been in this movement.
When you look at the shift that has occurred in our food system, you often have to stop and ask, where do ideas come from? And I think ideas come from the written word. You hear someone speak. How many people hear you speak? But a book, for example, gets passed around, and it's the ideas from the book that become passed around. I believe in that power of the written word, in that they help capture, express, and transform people by circulating ideas. And we live in a literate world, even though people talk about people are reading less. Actually, I think that's quite the contrary, especially with everything from Twitter to the internet. People are reading more than ever. They may not always be reading books, so the book industry is having a few issues, but they're still reading, and I think it's that power of the written word that expresses ideas is the part of that huge shift that occurs, and it continues to occur. In this, my latest book, Wisdom of the Last Farmer, I try to talk about that shift, but in a very authentic, personal way, about our farm, about my father and his recovery from his stroke, and the changing relationships on the land. That sense of authenticity to me is essential because, again, it's not just about intellectual ideas, it's about personal ideas, and it's that personal element that comes with an idea that I think becomes a driving and changing force, and I'm excited about it. I guess that's why I write. I write because I want to share our story, hoping that our story could have some positive impact.
David Mas Masumoto. His new book is Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land. It's just out from Simon & Schuster. David, always a pleasure. I thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This was a great joy.